Hey there, folks. I'm Todd Anthony Zeller.
And I'm Spun Counter Guy.
For all you wanderers, vagabonds, sinners, and saints,
welcome home. Welcome to the first episode of the Orphans of God podcast. I'd like to introduce my co-host here, Todd Zeller. He is a videographer, and he has done work with Mike Rowe of the 77s, Robert Diebel, Michael Knott, Adam again, and he's currently working on a documentary called Us Kids, which is about the Southern California Christian alternative music scene, starting back in the early 80s and forwards.
And my co-host, Spun Counter Guy, is a history professor in Kentucky. He's also an author of a book that focuses on the 1980s, the music scene, faith, and community. The book is called The 10 Tracks Mixtape Tasks.
We should say that we met on the internet, like a lot of great, wonderful, and horrible relationships often start. And we have yet to physically meet, but we have bonded over, I believe it was maybe Adam again and Michael Knott and some other, 77s for sure. I think we started seeing each other's posts and started to correspond, and so here we are.
So tell me, when did you first discover the music of Soup the Chemist?
In the early 90s, I had a job where it was for a machine shop company, and they had this abandoned lot that basically they had put the tractor trailers there to use as storage. So a lot of weeds had grown up, and they needed it cleared out and cleaned. Part of the problem was it was right across the road from the projects, and so you had young men who would often park their cars on the lot and party. There was also a couple homeless dudes that were living under the trailers, and this had been going on for many, many years, and so there was probably thousands of gin bottles that had been thrown, both in whole pieces and in some cases just broken and shattered. And so my job, part of it was to clean up all those gin bottles. And so it took me all summer. But one of the things that made that job enjoyable, in spite of being in the hot sun and, you know, having to smell the fumes of gin and human spit backwash in the bottles and getting bit by insects, was my Walkman and what I was playing that summer. And it was all the artists on Brainstorm Artist International, the chief of them being what was then called SFC, or Soldiers for Christ, or Soup the Chemist, or Chris Cooper. He was a rapper, and of course there was other artists that were on that label, not just hip-hop artists, but, you know, rock artists as well. And that just made me kind of look forward to the job, even though it was a terrible job. But, you know, I had tunes, and so I was happy. And so I always will be grateful for Chris's, how did you say, he kind of held my hand that summer and got me through all that.
I'm really excited about our time with Chris. What a genuine fella. What a great musician, a great thinker. And man, I was encouraged. Let's do it.
Yeah, so here's part one.
Still dreaming.
The secret flames.
Still dreaming.
Do you remember when you first heard, as they called it back then, rap music? And who were some of the artists that excited you or made you think, like, man, I want to do this?
Well, when I first heard it in 1978, 79, and I fell in love with it, getting wind of the movie Wild Style coming out, which they shot in, like, what was it, like, 81? You guys remember Blondie, right? She was responsible for making that movie happen, her and Fab Five Freddy, who was a graffiti artist. They shot it in 81, but it didn't come out until 83. But I had, since, you know, I'm originally from New York and all that, I had connections and got to see and hear about, you know, what was going on with it. And that's when I really fell in love with hip hop. That's what captured me. As far as a favorite artist, I never really had a favorite artist. I just have artists who I look up to. Because, you know, music is emotional, so it's all over the place. I like this dude today, this other guy tomorrow. I like this dude next week. You know what I'm saying? So
yeah,
I have, they're all my favorites. So.
Right.
I guess it just depends on my mood, but people I have utmost respect for, there's two crews. The first one would be the Cold Crush crew.
Get on the mic, got your eyes color. My goal is the same. I aim for fame. I don't pop no game.
He don't have no chain.
I put the chain because I have a brain.
And the second would be Freestyle Fellowship.
Once we have the knowledge of suffering some people, then we could be free and no devil could ever enter the boundary. I stand and listen around all these sounds. I see blessing all that I found the key. That's how we be.
The sharp shooting wizard, but not a grand dragon. A chop off the block, but my pants ain't sagging. Got a strong.
I always bounce around everybody else, but those cats to me are the what hip hop is.
I'm familiar with Cold Crush, of course, but the Fellowship? Mm-hmm. Tell us about them.
Freestyle Fellowship was right here in L.A., 1985, man. They were, those dudes are still to this day are ahead of their time, but they never really got on a national level because of, you know, I hate to say it, but certain mindsets and certain things that happened, they fell into weird contracts, like I don't know if you remember or heard of Stetsasonic.
Oh yeah.
Well, there was a dude named Daddy-O. He kind of brung them to 4th and Broadway, which was the same label Rakim was on, and they did an album, and the single featured on Daddy-O. So you could already see where it was going, and it was the album. As soon as they dropped the album, one of the main members went to jail. So it was just weird. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just weird stuff. But it never took away from who they were. They were just talented, super talented cats who just really didn't make it on a level that they should have made it. But what was interesting is last year, they got, for that album that never really blew up, it was an underground classic, and they got nominated for a Grammy last year.
Really?
So
wow.
That album came out, like I said, in, I think it was 85.
Wow. Better late than never.
So that's probably why you never heard of Freestyle Fellowship, but you've listened and heard their DNA in everybody.
When did you start writing your own rhymes, and what did you talk about?
Well, I always wrote my own rhymes. So.
Yeah.
And one of my first songs, before I even, you know, became a believer in Christ, Christian, was a song called Too Cool for School.
Nice.
I was always on this positive tip, you know what I mean? And that was one of my first songs I wrote. It's called Too Cool for School. And we were just talking about, you know, cats that were dropping out, you know, and they just thought they were that cool. And, you know, and we talked, this is 86, 87.
Do you still remember the lyrics?
Not at all.
Gives me strength when I'm drained, delirious from my quest. Chris, you must understand your purpose before you can expect one to be blessed when they purchase a recording pack with ecclesiastical exhorting. I thank you, Lord, for once again with wisdom you showered me. A vessel who offends you daily, knowing this, but I still choose to disobey thee. My God, how can I ever repay thee?
Dust in the wind.
You mentioned your faith. When did you become a follower of Christ, as we say today?
Well, without telling you an hour-long story, I came into the faith from studying all type of religions, because before I came into Christianity, I was a Jehovah's Witness. I joined the Fruit of Islam, and then I got into metaphysics, mm-hmm. and then I was just whatever. Mm-hmm. And I started dipping into Christianity. So studying got me interested, but the reason I was even on this path of a higher being or whatever you want to call it was because of providence. If I feel God revealed things to me that made me see that, oh, there's something out there bigger than us. You dig what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I'm like, nah, there's something out there bigger than us. So that's what put me on this quest. And I think that he also ties into what we just talked about, me always being on a positive tip. It was like, I can only go so far with this diabolical mind state or sin or anything. I would go right up to the fence and stop because of providence. I kept remembering that God's hand and what he was trying to do with me mentally and spiritually. So that's what led me to start studying Christianity. And because I'm the type of individual who can't just, you can't just tell me something and I run with it. Whatever you tell me, I'm going to go home, look it up, see if what you're saying is real talk, and then make a decision. I never will just say, oh, yeah, I'm not moved by feelings, none of that. It's like, let me see, you know, what this is and what he's talking about and where the source is. Where did it come from? Why is he saying what he's saying? You know, so that was always my mind state. So when I went to Christianity, everything that I had studied before Christianity was actually right there with Christianity. It just veered off when you get to the Godhead and certain things that they had to veer off to, or they might as well just be Christianity. So, and because of that, Christianity made the most sense to me. And it was like, it resonated. And not only that, even though I didn't understand, I remember praying like, yo, man, this don't make no sense, you know? And when I took that approach, have you ever read something or looked at something and you go back to it a year, 2 years later, and you're like, oh, wait a minute, I didn't see that. Yeah. That's what started happening to me. Certain things I was reading, didn't understand, it started opening up. That's why I called one of my albums Illumination. That's exactly what it was. It was like, things were just becoming illuminated. And to me, that's what faith really means. Mm-hmm. Because I can't tell you why a cow eats green grass and then we squeeze its breasts and white milk come out. That don't make no sense. It should come out green, right?
Yeah. Good point.
So
what you said reminds me of a lot of people you hear that will say, it seems odd to Christians especially, we're taught to only read the Bible and nothing else outside of that. But you hear a lot of people say, like, you know, the road that helped me get to Christianity was maybe Buddhism or Taoism or Islam or any of these other things. And so are you kind of grateful that you went through that stage before you became a Christian?
Oh, I definitely am, because that's what actually rooted me to this day. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or I'd still be searching.
Right.
You know? And I agree. I used to be into apologetics. Mm-hmm. And one thing I noticed is that, as you just mentioned, you know, just read the Bible. To me, that's dangerous. And that's kind of dumb. You should even study the Bible. You know, if you really even just studied the origin of the Bible, you would understand that there were 11 Bibles made before the King James Version. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it just, there's just all kind of stuff that you know, people need to. I mean, the Bible even talks about that. What's that scripture? 1 Peter 3:15, where it says to study and have an answer for everybody. You know, don't just say, oh, it's Jesus, bro. It's Jesus. Yeah. You need to believe it. Nah, man, it's bigger than that. Yeah. You know what I mean? So, yeah, that's never been my thing.
Yeah.
And I believe that's because of me coming into it with that mind state is why I'm still a firm, strong believer today.
On that note, I'm just curious, like, I'm one who really enjoys, like, discovering that archaeological evidence. And, you know, when, especially all these years later, if you've been a Christian for a good chunk of your life, like we all have probably, I love how when time passes, you know, more and more archaeological evidence is starting to show and support the scripture. And I just find that, you know, we're all scientific in the end. But you were right. There is that emotional aspect of any religion, really. But I'm not one who loves to just rely on emotion either. I appreciate hearing your backstory on that.
That's deep that you said it, because I was just having a conversation with an individual on this aspect, and he's a firm believer. I don't know about now, but he was a firm believer in he was one of, like, I don't even know what they call them, but they believe the earth is flat and all that.
The flat earthers. Yeah.
Flat earther, I think.
The flat earther. And back when that became a thing, they lacked what we have now. You know what I'm saying? So, okay, I could see somebody who was in this certain area and didn't understand how to even go around the rest of the world seeing something like that and teaching it. But in today's technology and science and everything, nothing supports that. So,
right.
You know what I mean? Right. So it's like, as science is catching up with the Bible.
I have to talk about this in my history classes I teach, and the attitude before, like, the 1800s by the Catholic Church, the doctrine was, if science contradicts Scripture, then we're not reading Scripture correctly, because, you know, God is the author of science, is the author of nature, so he wouldn't contradict himself. So that's how they would explain things like the four corners of the earth, as is mentioned in the Old Testament, which, you know, it's allegory, obviously, you know, but yeah, I thought that was an interesting take on that.
The Bible hasn't really changed, so it's science catching up to the Bible.
Right.
Because if you really study and you look at things, there's things in the Bible that tells you, like, for instance, let's just take waste, how they would tell them to take it out of the city because it would do certain things, you know, our body waste. They would, like, take it out of the city. That was just a teaching. Uh-huh. You know, we know we can't just be around a bunch of fetus and all that stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Are you saying certain things are innate in us, in our design as humans? Am I catching that right? I might be off.
I would, yeah, it's definitely, man. I mean, we could take what's right and what's wrong. You, as a child, you could kind of, without anybody telling you, you already kind of know, all right, this ain't mm-hmm. cool, but I'm gonna test it. You did? Yeah. You know, man, we know. It's just, we don't accept. Or we try to justify it and make it what we want it to be. You know what I mean? Like, I was just reading a perfect example of, I mean, going a little deeper, is something that Kanye West just said. You know, if you guys were paying attention to him, he released this whole Christian thing, whatever you want to call it, you know, him. But he just said the other day that he's basically denouncing everything he was talking about because he feels Jesus didn't answer any of his prayers.
It's like, wow.
I didn't hear that. Wow.
That's news to me, too.
Yeah. So you took a truth and made it your thing. Mm. You know what I mean? That's kind of online what we're discussing.
Right. So to... we're zooming out on the flat earth, so zoom back in on the part of earth where you inhabit. How did you get involved in starting to record your faith-based material? And, you know, I guess Broken Records would have been that first experience. Am I right?
You are right. Dave Guzman from JC and the Boys is responsible for that. I met him by calling into a radio station. He was a DJ that sat in and did this little segment where he would play hip hop. And then in between the hip hop, when he would talk, he would drop these little gospel references. And I'm like, and at that time I had begun to really get serious about serving God. And I wanted everything that I was doing to reflect that. So I actually started writing Christian raps. So I'm hearing this dude, and I'm like, wait a minute, this dude sounds like he's on my level a little bit, playing his hip hop, but he's talking about God in between his songs. So I called up. Like, long story short, the dude came to my house right after he got off the air.
Dang. We
talked, and then that night he showed me how to record on a four-track. He had a four-track recorder. And I recorded this song called Transformed. And then jump ahead, he formed this group called JC and the Boys. And that's where I met the Dynamic Twins and Peace 586 and Poetic Lee. And it was just a little crew, you know. And from that, me and I wanted to suck up Dave's wisdom. So I was always kind of hanging out with him. And he showed me how to put out. He put out his first cassette, sold it out. It was selling it out of the trunk. So I said, hey, man, I want to do the same thing. So I put out a whole little thing called Fully Armed out of the truck. And this was 1988. And from that, he took that same thing I pressed up and took it over to old Joe's Taylor, let him hear it, and then boom, that's how I got on.
Just can't see like violence, sex, and drug abuse. You want to like grab your Bible and put it to use, because if you read it, you will find out, my friend, that this world is gonna come to an end. Then I will know and you will know that is true, and you can tell someone else like I'm telling you to listen up.
So, Soup, why do people of faith, creative people of faith, still need to create in this day and age, be it songs or films? Why are their stories important? More specifically, why do you need to create?
Well, it's therapy. That's probably the best way I can explain it. It's almost like a football player. You got to force a football player to stop playing. Very few of them say I'm retiring, or like a boxer and all, you know, you almost kind of got to force them out. Okay, look, I'm not going to pay you as much. I'm not, you know what I mean? Whatever the thing is, brings them to that realization that it's time to walk away. But they really don't walk away because this is all they know. They've been, you know, so it's the same thing with artistry and music. And since it's emotional and spiritual, you don't really just walk away from it. You know what I mean? You just, times change. You might can't keep up or whatever, but you're probably still out there doing podcasts, something.
Yeah.
And so it's therapy. This is your life. You're really connected to it. You don't, you know, the only cats that you never hear from ever again, they were created. Somebody gave them the song, somebody made the beat for them, all that. It was never them. They were a created artist. But the ones that are still here after all these years, still connected, all that, it's therapy, and we're connected. It's part of our DNA.
To give you some of my background, I started listening to rap like with the Fat Boys and Run DMC and all that. But in high school, I started to really think about trying to be more serious in faith. So I started to look for Christian alternatives or what do you call it? Maybe additives to the music that I was already listening to. So I first remember Stephen Wiley was the first Christian hip hop I ever heard. So I had that. And then eventually, what was it? Michael Peace, I believe. And then JC and the Boys, then your first record. But then you put out A Saved Man, and that just became something else completely. Like it pushed things to another level, as the kids say today.
Super, MC Super, see your black buses in your speaker for
me. I'm like cool and calm, sometimes mellow. Brush my teeth so they don't turn yellow. A little right guard so I won't smell. And I'm praising God cause I'm saved from hell. Well, I'm the doctor, you're the patient. You've been injected, and when it's injected, your life's affected. Cause what was injected into your ear went straight to your brain. And try to sin cells, remove the sin stains. Now you can live how God intended. If you haven't experienced it, I recommend it. Directions, follow these. You just put this in your speaker.
So my question with that is, what was the difference? What was the change? And I guess some of this would be about you and DJ Dove getting together. And I guess, can you explain all that history?
Yeah, well, that's funny that Saved Man in the Jungle album. Mm-hmm. I actually, well, first off, on my first recording, I had like the cheapest drum machine ever. Yes. You know what I'm saying? four drum machine is through the whole record. It's the same sound through the whole record.
Right. But that was common for the time, really. I mean,
but not in 1988. You had a lot of dope production coming out. True. I just didn't know how to do it.
Sure.
I wasn't around people who could show me how to do it, because you had your Marley Mars. You had Marley Marl was the king of New York at that time, and the way his production was just amazing, and that's what I wanted to sound like, but I didn't know how to get it. Uh-huh. You had Dre out here on the West Coast starting to get away from the Miami sound that we had. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of changes. I just didn't know how to capture it, but I did the best I could with that core drum machine.
Yeah.
So when I came to Save Man in the Jungle, Broken actually gave me the money to buy a MPC 60. But my mistake was, I was a kid in a candy store. I got this new machine. I didn't even get married to it. I just started messing with it. Mm-hmm. So, and what I mean by that is, that album could have been so much better if I didn't sample. All the samples on that album were totally distorted. And we spent a bunch of time in the studio trying to fix it.
Oh, man.
Crazy. But a cool thing was, Gene was a big record collector. And when I had got saved, I used to be a DJ first. But I got rid of all my record collection because I wanted to. I just felt God wanted me to do that, which I wish I wouldn't have done it. But that's what I did.
Yeah.
So I had like this little stack of records. I remember telling Gene about all this. And he says, man, you should come by my house. And in my back room, I just got records everywhere. I don't even know what I have back there. I said, really? So went back there. Man, everything you heard on that album was coming out of those records I found.
That's awesome.
He just had records everywhere. And I spent about 2 days in there. One day he had to literally come in there. Dude, are you all right in here? That's how much I was just in there looking at, just listening to records. It was just crazy. And that's how that album was getting. That's why it sounded so different. I had to have more resources.
Right.
And I was able to, even though I was still navigating through this whole Christian rap thing, I had all these resources to make it sound better to what I'm hearing in my head in the first place, as if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but Dove came actually later. Well, he was in there, but the reason Dove even came in was I was living off of that demo tape. He was with another rap group at a church called Victory Outreach. And he opened up for us as we came to perform there. Well, the guy he was rapping with didn't want to rap no more. So since I was in bed with Victory Outreach, performing all over the country with them, it was easy for Dub to get in contact with me. And he was like, hey, man, if you ever need a DJ, you know, I'm here. And since I am a lover of the art, you can't really be a hip hop artist without a DJ behind you. So I was like, heck yeah, man. So boom, that was our connection.
Well, no, I think it's interesting that I assumed that Dove was the one who chose all those samples, but it was actually you, and in a way, Gene Eugene. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, Dove didn't really do any production with me until we got to phase three.
Which, I'm just talking out loud. Like, I guess the difference between the first record and the second record was the lack of samples. Because if I recall correctly, on the first record, you sampled Ain't No Stopping Us Now, like a one track. And I think rest of it, like you said, was just drum beats, which is almost, I mean, someone could go back and add all kinds of samples. Well, if you want to pay for the clearance, I guess. But yeah, you know, they say there's a lot of hip hop records that could never be made today that were made back in the day because of the sampling. Man. I know for Todd, one of the highlights off of that album is the one song you did with Adam Again, in essence. Too Much Chemistry.
Oh, Too Much Chemistry.
Yeah.
Glide up in the back, scratching all that. Ban my manners, and again would send me into a mode where I have to explode with the gospel. It's impossible, yeah, it's being done. Having fun, praising the true one, God's son. No one that sits on the throne. Man, I'm like a dog on his bone. Me and his microphone, so don't try to stop.
snatcher all growl attack if it comes to that jack. I'm like,
back to the lab.
PA some more, have them astonished.
I thought it was great because it's the first time I remember an actual live band being used in hip hop. Now, I know that wasn't necessarily true because we were talking off recording about Rapper's Delight, which they actually did use a real band to imitate Sheik. But talk about how that came about.
Yeah, just messing around in the studio with Gene, man. We'd just be in there and just, you know, we're at the green room, man. And I was just like, it's a house studio, man. So we'd just be in there just tripping, man. And John Knotts was the drummer for Adam Again. Yeah, man, he's the one that came in, just started messing around on the drums. Gene came in there and started adding to it. And then that was the birth of kind of Too Much Chemistry. It wasn't even a planned thing like, hey, let me do this, dude. It just kind of came about and we're listening to it. And I'm like, man, let's put this on the 2-inch tape, man. And nice. And let me write to it. And then that's what we did.
So give me the beat, give me the mic, give me the crowd, and watch me start a big fire. Cause all it takes is a spark to burn down, tear apart, and crush. But like a big bad wolf, I'm up and puff. I just pump in and search, turn up the hurt. Go buck wild with some crazy outside. I'm not into rap, but fortune on the fame. I'm just here to praise and raise his name. Check me 2 years.
You know, I'm going to be on this Adam Again bed for a little bit just because I know you guys were around one another a lot. And I'm a big Adam Again fan, as you guys know. On that note, I mean, were you around the green room a lot or just when you were recording? Because I've always found like that community of artists that seem to collect around that hub, the green room, the fabulous green room. I know Gene kind of drew a lot of people in. And of course, he was working a lot of the time on actual albums.
Gene had a little spare bedroom. If artists weren't staying in there, I would go back there and just work, make beats and all that. So even if I wasn't hanging in the green room, I was in that room. It wasn't that far from the beach, and that's why I used to love to create. So because of all that, that energy, a lot of that energy was developed at that green room, even though I may not have been in the sessions. So yes, I was there a lot. And then when Gene would take breaks or whatever, you know, he would pull me in there. Hey, listen to this. Hey, you know what I mean? There'd be times he didn't even know I was there. We'd walking out like, oh, you're here. You know what I mean? So, so it was just cool like that he would allow me to work there because it was like a getaway, work, go to the beach, think, come back with an idea, work. It was just cool. Gene gave me the opportunity to do that with the green room.
I think when that vibe happens, you know, there's ocean, there's God's creation. You're feeling inspired. And then to have the tools and resources to just, boom, go in and act on it. Man, that's a God thing right there, if you ask me.
Yeah, that studio was a... It was a one beautiful studio, man. I wish somehow we all could have held on to it. I don't even know if it's still there or what. I don't know, but just the way it was set up, it was just crazy. You would never even think it was back there because you didn't hear nothing. It was soundproof so well that you would have to be inside the kitchen area to hear the humming of the bass, right? But then when you walk in there, you're like, man, dang, you know, I lost probably 30% of my hearing in that place, man.
They should put a plaque in the green room. At this spot, Chris Cooper lost 30% of his hearing.
Exactly.
It's a magical time, no doubt about it, man.
But on that note of magical times, as I mentioned, you know, you had other fantastic records that came out of, I assume, the Green Room. You had Caught in the Land of Time by Freedom of Soul. You had the Idle Kings album. You had Dynamic Twins' records. And you guys are all on each other's records during that time period. And it just sounds like you guys are having a blast. Was that the case?
Yeah, well, we were actually, if you look at the my Phase 3 release on the inside cover, that's everybody. They couldn't even all fit. The people we used to run with couldn't even fit in the picture. There was a total of 75 people there for that photo shoot that day.
Dang.
What?
And I called it the family. We were all the family. And you see every group, even groups that never even really made it. That's just the vibe I created, because that's what I wanted. I can't call myself Soldiers for Christ and it's just me, you know what I'm saying? So, you know, I networked and pulled in everybody. And back in those days, we didn't have no internet, none of this junk. So you literally had to hang out and talk with people. So that's what it was. You dig what I'm saying? And when I say we rolled, like just say Idol King was performing somewhere, but we're not on the bill. Mm-hmm. All of us would go to that concert. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And we would just, not to try to get on the mic, just to support and be down. And it would just, and because of that, people started getting wind of that. They would come to the concerts because they want to meet all of us. Uh-huh. So next thing you know, you got a full concert. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that was the energy back when it was, and I would say all the way to like 95. That's when things started kind of starting to change. But yes, we were having fun, and yes, it was like that.
I always think about I don't even know if you call it a track, but the track off of the Freedom of Souls record, Cookin' Bacon, where it sounds like you guys are all just having a good time. It's just a perfect moment.
Hey, hey, wait, listen to this, man. SFC Soup got a cow that moved backwards and it say, Om.
Yeah, we used to just have fun like that. I mean, if we would have been recording some of the sessions in the green room back in those days, it could be a comedy. Straight up comedy of just intakes of the green room.
All right. The crowd's hype, dump those in the peak with just the green light. For me to grab the steel, ignorance I feel like a grapefruit. Got in this group, yes, soup, formed in a furnace effect. So here's a fraction of what's happening. You're like a new match, and I'm just snatching down your kingdom, no sweat at all. Mr. Jericho Joshua, walking around you all, watching it fall to the ground like a ball.
During that, I guess you call it like an apex of, you had all your friends and your army together. What were some of the highlights besides making the records? I mean, obviously, you mentioned the concerts, but were you, not to be super serious, but was it also an opportunity to be evangelistic with the fans that you were gathering at that time? And also, was there a real good positive reaction to those records that were coming out? Were you getting support from media, whether it was Christian or secular?
To your first question... Mm-hmm. I always looked at evangelism, ministry, and all that after the concert. To me, while we were performing and all that, that was just strictly entertainment. Mm-hmm. I'm entertaining these people with faith-based entertainment. Now, when I get off that stage, and this is what separated me, not to down other crews or whatever, but this is what separated me from a lot of other crews, hip hop, rock, whatever, because we perform with a lot of rock people. I made it a point to my whole crew. I told them, after we perform, clean up all the sweat, and we all go to my merchandise table. And we stay there, we take pictures, we talk, we minister. That was like a mandatory thing for me. And we literally would stay there until the last person was, well, they were literally like, okay, we were going to turn the lights off in the place now. And to me, and the reason I did that is because that was real ministry to me. You know what I'm saying? And if you followed how Jesus got down, he would do something and then he would go hang out with everybody. They'd be following him all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. it's when you become unavailable, untouchable, and all that, to me, you're just like the mainstream people. What are you really doing? You know what I'm saying? So that was important to me. And because of that, to this day, 2024, I still see the fruit of that. I get emails and all this from when these dudes were little kids. They got pictures, they got letters, they got, remember 6x9s when we would sign them and stuff? These dudes are grown men, pastors, kids, all this, you know? And they still are thankful that I did that, even though I didn't do it to get recognition or anything. Actually, a lot of people that would roll with us, they didn't like to do that kind of stuff. And they looked down on, like, man, I ain't hanging out. I'm like, come on, man, that's what we do.
Right.
You know what I mean? So that was my move for that. That was true evangelism to me.
Very good.
And then what was this? Man, I talked so much I forgot to say.
That's okay. How was the reaction to all of those albums that were coming out of BAI at that time?
It was good and bad, of course, like anything. We went through the same thing that the Christian rock, underground, punk rock, all that they went through. Oh, this ain't of God, blah, blah, blah. We went through the same thing. It was the same thing. You know, every time you introduce something to somebody who believes in a negative way, it's going to produce that type of energy. And then, you know, hip hop has always been considered a worldly thing. So here we are bringing it into the church. So, of course, they're like, oh, are you bringing this world into the church? I mean, it was a guy, Greg G. Lewis or something. He made a whole living on attacking Christian hip hop. So, you know, of course, you had that, but then you had the people who could look beyond that and was really blessed from what we were doing. And as I spoke about still getting letters and all that stuff from that era, those eras, all of them say, you know, I was in school, I was in college, I was in high school, I was in elementary. And, you know, I was getting bombarded with all this negative hip hop. And you were like a break from all that. And it actually guided me a different way in my life because of things you were saying. From that, you introduced us to other artists. So it became like I didn't need that other stuff. I came engulfed in this positive, God-centered hip hop. And it kind of shaped me and helped me through life because they loved hip hop just like me. I love hip hop. And that was the reason I even started writing gospel raps, is because I was trying to get away from that lifestyle I was in. And we all know birds of a feather flock together, bird of the same feather flock together. So if I'm feeding myself all this other stuff subconsciously, it's good. Even without me knowing, it's gonna start coming out. I say make today the first day of the rest of your life. You know how you do that, man? Serve Christ and serve him is a have relationship. Not an understanding, because an understanding is shallow compared to a relationship which equals deep, real deep. So deep that when I speak that, a lot of so-called Christians gets bumped off the track. Flat on the derriere, pulls off dusty, elbows and knees, scratched up and bruised. Like Bobby Bland, boy, I got you singing the blues as I keep the good news like a football. I can't be coming out soft like a nerf. Did you face people that were like, oh yeah, man, you should get out of this Christian thing because this is for the birds, you know, you're not making money, you're not, whatever the case, you know? Did you encounter obstacles like that, that kind of pushback? Oh, definitely, all the time, man. But the interesting thing, Todd, is I think my mind state is what hurt me in my career. Because, and the reason I say that is because when I was doing my thing, there wasn't really nothing out there. I didn't even know of Stephen Wiley, Michael Keys, P.I.D. I didn't know. I thought I was, our little clique was the first Christian rappers ever. I actually thought I was the first until I met Dave Guzman. He was already kind of doing it. You know what I mean? And a lot of people don't recognize him or some of these other guys because they didn't feel they were authentic and good. So they kind of hate on him. But they were doing it already. But since I was doing it in my authentic type of way, it was nobody else doing it like that. So I felt that I had to learn everything on my own. And because of that, I didn't let other people in. I didn't let people manage me. I didn't do it. And I think I would have did a lot better if I would have had people around me telling me, you know, redo that verse. You know, let's do this. Let's market you this way. I would have had a better career. But because of my surroundings and the time I was in, I didn't run across those type of people. I didn't run across any of my back then. Let's just take Peace 586. He wasn't even making beats. There was nobody doing anything. I was kind of that guy. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So as I talked about all my samples being distorted, I didn't have no one to teach me. And then I got to a point where I didn't want anybody because I felt I needed to be in control of this. And I believe that hurt me. So even more than the people, you know, talking smack and all that, that didn't really bother me that much. I mean, from the streets, man, that didn't do nothing. You know what I'm saying?
Right, right. So today, I mean, sounds like you really believe in that concept of mentoring maybe a younger generation. Do you see that in your own life, in your own sphere of friends and such?
Oh, most definitely, man. I believe, how could I say it? The internet has changed things now. Mm-hmm. People are getting mentored without telling you that you're mentoring them because they'll spend time on you. They won't tell you, but they're checking everything you do and they're taking it in, but they're not giving you the credit. So it's happening. Mm. It's just people are being selfish with it. They're not sharing it too. You know what I mean? Because that makes sense. But
yeah, I hear what you're saying. I
believe that there's nothing being done right now on any level where people aren't getting mentored by somebody. They're just being selfish and telling you they did it without this, but they're studying. If you're studying, you're being mentored.
Yeah, we've lost a lot of that personal connection, I think, with the internet. One of the downfalls of the internet
allow people to not be personal with it. They can choose how they want to be mentored and, you know, take. But I believe it's important. And I'm going through that with my son right now. He looks up to me. He believes in what I say, but he likes to listen in his own way.
Yeah, I hear that.
I don't drink the brew, no need to snort a line. I don't have time, cause God's on my mind. Not on the sea line, but getting closer to the spout, no doubt. Put the glory shoots out, now my cup is full. Matter of fact, overflowing, motivates me to grab the mic and start blowing. Just like a breeze, straight through the trees. Consuming and removing all dead leaves, so please, don't talk on the walk. I told you up front what kind of jams I bump. The kind that's...
During that time period, you know, you're having a good time, you're collaborating with all these different artists, and I assume you're playing the festivals as well at the Christian venues and the concerts, and you're interacting with not only other Christian hip-hop artists, but also, like, you've mentioned, like, the punk and the metal people. You name-check the Crucified on your Phase 3 record and amongst other people. How was that to you, and do you have any great stories from that time period of feeding off of or, you know, becoming friends with all these folks that are trying to do basically the same thing you are, or maybe they're not trying to do the same thing?
Yeah, man. I mean, basically, that was probably 75% of my career was in front of rockers. And I think because of the label I was on had a lot to do with it as well. But one of my very first festivals was at Cornerstone. my album, the day I performed at Cornerstone was the day Listen Up actually got, was coming out. I mean, we had to get a special order sent to Cornerstone, you know, because it wasn't even out yet. It went straight from the pressing plant straight to Cornerstone in Chicago. So I hadn't even seen it. Gene orchestrated all that. And they put me in the new artist tent. And I don't know if I was the first rapper there ever or what. But what I do know is when I was doing my sound check, the place filled up to capacity to the point where they had to actually put cones outside and say that no one else could come in because it was a safety hazard. It's a sound check.
Love that. That's incredible. So, love that.
And nobody left. And Gene was just sitting over there like, man, I ain't never seen nothing like this. I said, okay. Well, I wouldn't know because I never seen nothing like this. There wasn't one black face. I think the only black face in there was, once again, John Knox with Adam again. He was only, it was me and him.
Love it.
Cause nowadays people know me rap for money or the fame. Tell me whatever happened to respect.
I'm feeling frustrated frequently by flows being fed to me on FM frequencies. Formats of raps that lack energy, destiny, originality, and it be stressing me.
I've seen some video of an Adam McGinn set somewhere at Cornerstone. I don't know what year exactly, maybe 90s somewhere. And I'm pretty sure the encore, bunch of people start jumping up on stage and you're leading that from what I can recall. You're popping onto the mic and there, I mean, there's like 35, 40 people up there along with Adam McGinn and you and a few other maybe DJs and rappers. I don't know. But can you tell us some backstory on that?
Yeah, that was, once again, that was Gene's whole vibe, man. He was just like, we're all here. It was a marketing thing too. I mean, we're all on his label, so you know.
Yeah.
It was just a fun time, man. You know, Adam again. They loved them dudes at that. I think they were there every year. Yeah. So, yeah, and because of that, that's what got me on the main stage. Even though I enjoyed the new artist stage a lot better, man, it was just more intimate. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's a whole nother story though, but that's how it went down, man.
Freaking speaking with the vernacular that attracts inner city cats wearing many hats, but we would love to just live off a rap and we keep it rotating like a back spin.
Hey everyone, thanks again for joining us. We're really excited for installment 2, part 2 of our conversation with Chris Cooper. Look for it to drop in a couple weeks. Thanks for your time, everyone.
The opening song is Orphans of God by Mark Hurd, thanks to Dan Russell and Fingerprint Records.
I'm still the rugged renegade who loves to rip it. Hit the thrift store for vinyl, take it home and wreck it in an artsy way so the loops can't be detected. I got fans, baby, because I'm keeping it high. Around the clock, running.